Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, and I'm joined today by Megan Boxer. How are you doing, Megan?
Good, thanks, John.
Excellent. And Julia, for sure. How are you doing, Julia?
I'm good, John.
Again, you're here. Is this the third week in a row?
Third week in a row.
Good work. So, this week is the peak of the summer results season. I think next week we have something like 23 pages of results in the magazine. So I know you are all very, very busy on the company's team. So we will keep this as laser focused as we possibly can. Let's, start with the news and the news section itself. Julia, Ryanair, what's happening there? As everyone jets off to their summer holidays, this is a very appropriate story. For many people, their summer holidays have been a bit of a nightmare.
It certainly has, yeah. The French air traffic controller strikes in France are just causing endless problems for these airlines flying through. And Ryanair was the latest one to update the market with how much they've been hit. And so profits for the quarter are down by about a fifth because of this. And for them, last week on the podcast, we spoke about EasyJet, and although they'd kind of taken a exceptional cost hit from these strikes, they still managed to upgrade profit expectations for the full year. But the kind of the difference with Ryanair and some of these other airlines, where this is kind of an exceptional cost and it's quite temporary, is they're also dealing with strikes with their own staff as well, mainly up in Ireland. So that's kind of why Ryanair has been dealing with the situation kind of particularly badly compared to some of its peers.
Right, so it's kind of a jumble of problems that really means it can't actually focus its attention on solving them anywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, I think we have Ryanair on a hold, so we're looking past some of this this disruption.
We do, yeah. While there is major disruption, they are making progress. So at the end of last year, they've started recognising unions for some of their crew, which mm-hmm. the pilots had been demanding for quite some time, and Michael O'Leary in the past has been very vocal about his dislike for unions, but finally the company has begun to recognize them. So now as of now, I think about 66% of its staff is now represented by a union, which is quite fairly substantial since they only started at the end of last year.
It is chunky. I mean, generally speaking, the job of a union is obviously to protect its staff from unfair working practices, but also to make sure that its staff get the best pay deal. So does the fact that Ryanair is now having to deal with unions suggest that they could be facing cost increases?
Oh, they already have over the period. That was one of the biggest cost increases, was the fact that they're having to pay their pilots more as well. But one of the also big announcements that just came out this week having to do with their staff is that they're going to cut the number of planes based in Dublin by about a fifth, down from about 30 to about like 23 or 24. And they're gonna, because one of the main areas for the strikes was in Dublin, the mm-hmm. Irish pilots were not pleased with their working conditions, and so now they've announced that from this winter they're going to substantially cut the number of planes they're going to have based there and move them to what they feel are more profitable routes instead. They see a lot of opportunity, especially in Poland, they say.
Yeah, indeed. I actually didn't know about this airline, Ryanair Sun, which you mentioned here.
Just the branding for the Polish division, really.
Absolutely. I didn't know they had a separate division, which is strange because we fly to Poland, but there you go. Another airline that is doing well, which is also significantly focused on Poland, is Wizz.
That's right.
And they've had some numbers this week that looked okay.
They are. They still had to cancel a number of flights, but since they're just a much smaller scale airline than something like a Ryanair or an EasyJet, where both of them, because of the French strikes, had to cancel upwards of 2,000 each, Wizz Air had to cancel 145 of theirs, which is expected to wipe about 14% off profits.
Okay, so not that great then.
Not great, but smaller scale than some of the others. But yeah, they certainly haven't been immune to these.
What have you on Wizz as an investable share?
We have them on a buy tip right now, so we think there's very good prospects for that. They've managed to increase capacity quite substantially over the past couple of years, but not at the expense of load factor, being how full the planes are. So yeah, they keep adding capacity and they keep filling the seats. So
And I think one of the points you make in terms of differentiation between Ryanair's investment case and EasyJet and Wizz Air is that the latter, EasyJet and Wizz, have, in our opinion, in your opinion, made much better preparations for what might happen with Brexit.
That's a key thing as well. They both have, because Wizz Air is based in Eastern Europe, EasyJet's based in the UK, they've both got the kind of respective air operator certificates that they'll need. So Wizz Air got one for the UK, they have a base in Luton now. EasyJet got one in Austria, so they're all set. No matter what the outcome of Brexit is, they should be fine, because the issue is that there's no like WTO aviation deal to fall back on like some of the other sectors would have. Whereas Ryanair, in the past, they've been very vocal that they're very anti-Brexit and pushing the government to come up with an aviation deal, or else they'll have to cancel a bunch of flights. They wouldn't be able to fly quite a few of them. But then in the update earlier this week, they've announced they've applied for an air operator certificate, but because a certain proportion of the shares have to be based in the EU, they said that they might be forced to restrict the voting rights on some of these UK shareholders, which I can't imagine will go down very well with shareholders.
No, that won't go down well at all, but there you go. So not our favourite pick in the sector.
No, but I suppose if it means the planes can still fly, then it's something that they're just going to have to do.
That's true. I mean, one thing that would worry me slightly if I were Wizz would be that Ryanair are essentially coming to have a crack at their patch.
Yeah.
Is that a genuine threat for Wizz, Ryanair shifting its focus to Eastern Europe?
I mean, there's no way it couldn't be a focus, but I think that Wizz Air is, they know the Central and Eastern European market so well that I think they kind of have that sort of home turf advantage.
Okay. I've never flown with them, funnily enough. Maybe try it one day. Okay. Thank you very much. EasyJet is an interesting company that was formerly run by Carolyn McCall, which is a very nice segue into the results section this week, because we had some results from ITV, which were very good.
They were very good.
And yet the shares continue to languish at a very lowly rating.
Yeah. I just don't really understand why they are. Well, I do understand why they are. People are overlooking the fact that they are a producer as well as a broadcaster, and they're just looking at the broadcasting operations,
which rely
heavily on advertising, and obviously the wider market is in a state of decline because of things like Facebook and Google. But ITV isn't reliant on its advertising anymore. It's less than half of its revenues, and it's got this amazing production company which makes programs which aren't just shown on ITV. It's the biggest content producer in the UK, which is enormous. And
bigger than the BBC.
Apparently, yeah, although I'm not sure what you take from commercial. So they're the biggest commercial content producer, but the BBC does have a commercial arm as well, so it's bigger than that.
Oh, that's true. I mean, the BBC will definitely package up its dramas and flog them off.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
it sells them. Yeah, and not just its dramas, it sells like Top Gear all over the world.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think it's very interesting as a kind of corporate management story here, and we were chatting yesterday over a beer after a long press day, and, I mean, the management here is really important. So the reason I mentioned Carolyn McCall, obviously she's now the new chief exec of ITV. We thought she did a great job at EasyJet. We thought she did a great job before that at The Guardian.
Yeah.
And she really is a manager who's proved her salt.
Yeah.
Building on a great legacy from Adam Crozier. I mean, from what you've written, it doesn't sound like she's reinventing the wheel here, but it's a kind of, she's made that strategy her own.
A strategic refresh is what she calls it. But it's a sensible strategy. It sounds very good. But like you say, it's not only that she didn't necessarily need to have a new strategy. The strategy was already in place. But she's come into a company which has been languishing for a few years in terms of its share price, and she's just a fresh pair of hands on the wheel, and it was the right thing to do, to stamp her mark on the company. And she is so impressive when she speaks, and when she speaks about the strategy and the growth and where the growth is coming from, she's great. And it sounds like the right thing to do, in that they're going to focus a lot more heavily on the production side of things. They're going to try and launch, and there aren't very many details about it at the moment, but they're calling it a direct-to-consumer platform, which sounds like it's going to be some sort of streaming service based around what is currently the ITV Hub, which has a lot of subscribers. It's got, I think, 75% of the UK's 16 to 24 year olds.
This is their digital catch-up player.
Yeah,
it's not great.
It's better than it was.
Yeah,
but
technologically it's not great.
No, but if you look at BBC iPlayer, how far it's come in the last 6 months. BBC iPlayer was barely usable before, and they've clearly done some massive digital revamp there, and now it's very good. And ITV Hub is not great, but
room for improvement.
Yeah, and they're focusing on it, and they're speaking to potential partners. I don't know whether those partners are other broadcasters who they'll share content, or whether it's a tech platform. I really don't know, but whatever, regardless, it sounds like the right idea.
Yeah.
Interestingly, though, they did have a question on the media call, which was how many of these streaming services are people willing to pay for, which is a really good point, because
for me right now, all of them.
Yeah, and that's what she said. She was like, we in our family have, this is Karen McCall, we have Amazon Music and Spotify, and loads of households do, and we have Netflix and Amazon Prime, and if ITV Hub went behind a paywall, probably get that too.
Yeah. What have you got? What have you, all of them?
I've got Netflix, and then for music, I use Apple Music.
Okay. I don't have a music streaming service.
No, neither do I.
Because I've got too many CDs, so I don't need it. But I have, yeah, Netflix, Amazon, and what's the other one? The Sky one, Now TV.
Now TV,
which
yeah.
I quite like. So, I mean, it is interesting, potentially going head-to-head with Netflix here. Netflix, I mean, let's move to Netflix. There's so much to talk about this week. Netflix had some numbers this week which weren't great.
They were pretty bad. Well, yeah, they were bad compared to their expectations, and that's why the share price fell so much, because everyone thinks Netflix is going to just keep growing and keep attracting a population the size of the UK in every quarter.
I remember you told me what the numbers were, what they were expecting, what they actually got. What they got is huge. What
500 million is what they got. They were expecting 600 million.
500 million more subscribers.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just extraordinary numbers we're talking about here.
Yeah.
But the expectations were for perfection, 600, and the shares got hit quite heavily.
Yeah, 14% on the day, which, yeah, it's a big move for a company that size.
And we saw this week as well in the tech space. So we had some good numbers from Google.
Yeah,
Alphabet even.
Yeah, which was surprising. They were particularly good because they had this massive fine earlier in the month, which obviously didn't affect these numbers, but they thought that Google might have to temper its earnings guidance for the year because of that fine. But they've made so many cost savings that they've actually come in ahead of earnings, even though they've been fined 4.3 billion euros.
It's extraordinary. We've got figures from Amazon and Apple coming out later today.
Yeah, Apple's next week, but Amazon's
next week,
tonight.
Sorry. Obviously, we can't talk about those. But the share price of those companies have been flying. In fact, all the fangs, apart from Netflix. And this morning, Facebook, which took a bit of a beating. What happened there?
So they had results as well, which were... Actually, they were quite poor. Their revenue growth was average. I think it was about 11%, but they're not. Subscriber numbers in the US were flat. Subscriber numbers in Europe were down, which doesn't only mean that people aren't subscribing, it means they are cancelling their accounts. That's not a good sign. And there was growth everywhere else apart from Europe and the US.
But to what extent are they cancelling? I mean, is it...
Oh, it's not very big, but I mean, it's not a good sign.
No. But it's a huge company.
Yeah.
I mean, you talk about a 20% price fall, they're wiping $140 billion from the value of that company.
Yeah.
It's vast.
Mm.
But I think the point here is that, you know, Netflix essentially missing its numbers, very high expectations, achieving an incredible level of growth, but still seeing its shares suffer. You know, are these tech stocks priced for perfection? One misstep, as I concluded my editorial, and they're going to get punished, which seems to be what's happened. And my great worry, this is another great segue here, Fevertree Drinks might be occupying the same category of expectations. And they've had some results this week.
They have, yeah. They definitely, I would say they're certainly in that category as well, but they have yet to falter, I would say.
Mm.
But yeah, the results this week, they were very good. It was interims this week. And the big focus right now is this shift to the US. They, alongside the results announcement, they announced that they'd signed a deal with Southern Glazer's Wine and Spirits, which are the largest North American distributor for alcohol.
Okay.
And so they're kind of going to work alongside them. They operate in 29 states, and the chief executive was saying, Tim Warillo was saying that they're kind of like the 29 key states where people, because you kind of get a few more conservative ones where people aren't really drinking very much, so they don't really care about those. But yeah, no, they, so this is going to be huge. It's going to allow them to run national campaigns alongside, so they'll be like the exclusive partner with this distributor. So that's a great way to work in there. It was towards the end of last year they announced that a dedicated management team would be set up in the US. Mm-hmm. So that's all now fully established and ready to go. And one of the key concerns right now is that it's still a bit expensive to, they manufacture all of the tonic and all of the drinks in the UK, and then they then have to ship them over to North America. So that can be a bit expensive. But they said, not necessarily in the immediate term, but not too far away, they'd be looking at building a distribution and manufacturing site somewhere in the US, likely on the East Coast somewhere. So that could cut down those costs right now.
Okay. I mean, it is interesting. I didn't know the Americans were into their gin and tonics that much. But obviously, we know that Fevertree does more than just tonic now.
That's right, yeah.
But there you go. Maybe they like the quirky Britishness of the old G&T.
I'd say it's still a very popular drink in North America.
Is
maybe
it
not as popular as it is here, but it's definitely common.
Everyone's gin crazy over here. This is a business that ultimately still is doing the vast majority of its business in the UK.
Oh, definitely, yeah. The UK is still the by far their largest market. I think making up about 3/4 worth of sales at this point.
Yeah, something like that.
The US is closer to 15. So still got lots of room to grow. So that's why
saying that the UK is gin crazy, is there not an argument to say that Fevertree has helped make the UK gin crazy.
Oh, the chicken and egg discussion here. Well, I don't know.
A couple of years ago, you couldn't go into a pub without there being a Fevertree menu. And they were glossy menus, which they were distributing free to pubs all over the UK, but not necessarily pubs that even stocked their stuff. But you make people interested in gin if there is a nice menu which gives you all the things that you can have with your gin. And
Fevertree helped their on-trade distributors, the pubs basically, and bars do that.
Yeah.
So clever marketing. They could go over to America and do something similar, convince America to become as gin crazy as we are.
Create your own market.
They've done a very good job at doing that.
So I guess this is why. I mean, people look at these shares in this company, and it is, you know, it's great. You can't fault it, and that's kind of where we are, and why the shares are where they are. But they are very, very expensive. I think forward PE of
78 at the time that we wrote the results. So it's kind of a tough argument. We've been saying this for a really long time, that there's so much growth, there's so much opportunity, but are they too expensive to justify an entry point? And we've been saying this for a very long time, and the shares continue to do extremely well.
Over the years, there have been some companies that remind me of this story. ASOS is one of them we were talking about earlier. You know, you always looked at those shares, what a rating, but they just go up and up and up. Same true of Amazon. What's that trading on now?
250 times.
Bargain. So, yeah, I mean, you just... My worry is, though, that, you know, with an undertaking as big as trying to crack the US, and Fevertree is ultimately a relatively small company in that industry still, it needs perfect execution to justify that share price.
It does, but, I mean, looking at their track record, they don't really have any black marks on the record, so it's certainly a difficult task, but when you think about how much opportunity there is in the US market to grow, then if they do it well, it could be really dramatically excellent for the company.
Sounds to me like you need to get off the fence there, Julia.
Well, if people are willing to pay 78 times forward earnings, I think there's still lots of room for growth.
Yeah, I think, I mean, this company has a lot of fans. You know, it's one that I see often people talking about on Twitter. Which company will get to 40 quid a share first? Fevertree or, I think it's Games Workshop, the other one that they have in that little game. The price here in the magazine is 3671. There was a weird spike in the shares on the day we looked at it, because we've got a 12-month high here of nearly 40 quid.
Yeah, nearly getting to the 40 quid mark.
That's really weird, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was just kind of an intraday shot up and then came back down again.
But. Yeah, I have no idea what happened there. We need to have another look at that. Okay, Fevertree. So you say hold, but really, I think you sort of mean buy if you're brave. same page. Let's go back to the management theme and delivering on strategy. GSK. This is a very strange story.
Yeah.
What is going on here?
Something new, apparently. They have decided it's time for a strategic revamp, and now they're focusing on science and R&D, and specifically genetics.
So this is really strange in the context of management. Again, we were discussing this when we were discussing Carolyn McCall yesterday. GSK brought in Emma Walmsley, am I pronouncing that correctly? And she had a consumer goods marketing background.
Yeah, she was the head of the consumer health division at GSK.
So the assumption was that here, this company would now be going down the consumer healthcare route rather than the big science route that AstraZeneca has chosen to go down. And everyone thought that was a grand strategy and she was the right person to lead it.
When you say everyone thought it was a grand strategy...
Some people thought it was.
Most people thought it was the wrong strategy, but the old chief executive, Andrew Witty, was convinced it was the right strategy, as was the chairman. And clearly now they have decided... maybe those two men were wrong and we need a new strategy. But then they've employed someone who was employed to pursue the old strategy. So whether Emma Walmsley is the right person to pursue the science strategy, I don't know. I don't think so.
This sounds like it could get a bit messy.
Yeah, I don't find her particularly good. I think she's been there for too long. She's just been dragging her feet and not really doing anything.
Don't pull your punches, Megan.
I mean, she's not, but Karen McCall. She's employed these well, she, people are saying, oh, she's made some really good roles in R&D, but she had to because everyone left. Their old head of R&D left. He went to work for the government. Someone else was poached by AstraZeneca. Yeah, they've poached someone else back from AstraZeneca, but there's been so much change in management. They're losing their FD.
It's kind of a brain drain situation from the sound of things.
Yeah.
That takes back to like Tesco. I remember when Tesco had their big management change after Terry Lee. Someone got the job.
Yeah.
Philip Clark. But everyone else left because they didn't get the job.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that it is probably what happened with the finance director. He was probably felt like he was overlooked and he's gone. But yeah, they have got some good people in the R&D team now. Someone called Hal Barron is now the head of R&D and he's got a good track record. But how can you have a chief executive who's overseeing that whole strategy, whose background is not in science at all? The chief executive of AstraZeneca is a scientist. He's a businessman as well, but he's a scientist at heart. Shire's chief executive is a scientist. Mm. If you're going to be running a science-focused pharmaceutical company, then I think you need a scientist at the top of it.
Yeah, I think that would make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
This mess, and to me it does look like a mess.
Yeah.
You know, it, kind of the buck you would think stops with the chairman here.
Yeah, I do. I think he's not great, but yeah, I don't like the chairman either. I don't love GSK, but I do think it's being overlooked. And I think the new strategy is the right one, whether there are the right people in place to actually execute it. But I think changing the strategy was the right thing to do. And now they look like they're heading in the right direction. And they were decent results, although they had some bad news today, actually, from one of their drugs. It didn't get approved. And it's all about the drug approvals.
Yeah, we got the shares on a buy.
Yeah.
So after all those faces and character assassinations there, buy.
It's a begrudging buy. I personally am not a fan, but looking at it from an objective point of view, they are quite cheap considering they have a good dividend, which is now well covered. Their debt is very high at the moment, but that's only because they bought the rest of Novartis's consumer healthcare division. That's the other part of this strategy, which is crazy. This time, 6 months ago, they were considering, and they'd actually made a bid for Pfizer's consumer healthcare business, which might have been $20 billion. And they then bought Novartis out of the rest of their consumer healthcare joint venture. It cost them, I think it was about £15 billion. And their net debt's now very high because of that. Why were they doing that if it's all about the R&D?
Yeah. It's all very very good questions, which I think I'm sure you'll put to management at some point.
Yeah,
in the future.
And I did actually speak to someone really good he's got a big holding in GSK, and he really likes the strategy. So
the new one.
No, this was actually before they changed the strategy.
This is not clarity of strategy. This is the opposite of what we're seeing at ITV.
Yeah, completely.
I know which one whose shares I would rather buy.
Yeah, ITV is great and it's cheap.
Yeah, absolutely. Funny enough, GSK pops out of a few of the screens in the cover feature that you've written this week, Julia.
That's right. Yeah, pharmaceutical companies can be a bit of a tricky one when it comes to corporate debt, which is what the feature focuses all about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a great feature. It's quite long, so. Now, I mean, let's just give it a bit of a plug, and I think it's best that readers go off and have a read themselves. But what we're trying to do here is really get to the bottom of how you as an investor should look at the debts that companies have. Should we be scared of debt?
Absolutely not, no. And but as the feature kicks off with, UK or debt among UK-listed companies is currently the highest it's ever been. And so that might sound like it should be bad news, especially because kind of ahead of the last financial crisis, it kind of spiked as well. But it's just, as the feature goes into a lot of detail, the profile of this corporate debt is much different than it was this time 10 years ago. So kind of more of a focus on long-term debt rather than short-term debt. So if the Bank of England does indeed increase interest rates, as there's been a bit of murmur about, it wouldn't be such bad news as it was, or as it would have been if the focus had been on much more short-term debt, which is much more exposed. Beyond that, we look at how this is broken down within different sectors, which sectors can deal with quite high levels of debt, which ones can't, and why, and name some specific companies and examples. And then
it's one of your sectors that's the key offender.
It is. Should I give it away?
Yeah, go on. No, you can tell us that.
Yeah, consumer goods companies tend to be the highest. British American Tobacco right now is the most highly indebted company that's listed in London. And that's largely because they took on quite a lot of debt to buy Reynolds America last year. And they have results out today, which are good. So arguably, taking on that much debt was worth it. They also did a share of issuance at the time as well. But it's these consumer goods companies that tend to have fairly steady streams of cash flow. And so that cash flow can then be used to service the payments on that debt. So that makes it much less risky than, say, a pharmaceutical company where, as Megan said before, it's all about the drug approvals. And
yeah.
It's so hard to tell whether or not those are going to come through. So they perhaps can't take on quite as much.
But big pharma companies do like a nice bit of debt, don't they?
Yeah, well, they need it because otherwise they can't afford to invest in their drug discovery.
Invest in their drug discovery or pay their dividends.
Yeah, we are mainly paying their dividends at the moment.
I mean, this is
GSK.
This is one of the reasons we've looked at this, because there is a question. It came up in the income ages feature that we did recently that companies may be borrowing to flatter their dividends, flatter their financial performance, their share price performance through buybacks. Should we be worried about the sheer amount of money that's being borrowed to spend on buybacks and pay dividends?
Honestly, I think it depends what type of sector you're looking at. I mean, doing sort of a leveraged recapitalization where you issue debt to buy back shares is not always necessarily a bad thing. It just depends on whether the company can actually service that debt. Debt's never a bad thing unless they can't keep up with it.
Indeed, and I think you say in the feature it's probably one of the first ports of call beyond internal cash flows for a company looking to finance its business. Equity can be very expensive.
It can.
Tech companies don't like to borrow too much. For obvious reasons.
They can't afford to borrow too much because they'd be given the most ridiculous interest rates. So any biotech or tech company which has debt, that is, if it's not making money yet, one of the early stage ones.
I think the point you make in the feature about tech companies and debt is that it's to do with the nature of their asset base.
Yeah, they have such a high level of intangible assets that it's difficult to put. They clearly can put a solid number on that, but if something were to go wrong, they went into financial distress, it's kind of questionable whether, if they were to revalue that, can you really sell a brand name?
Well, I think you can.
You can.
But it's software technology, IP, know-how.
The intellectual property and stuff, yeah. It's
and
much
you definitely
more difficult
can't
to
sell a concept which may or may not work in the future, if it doesn't work in the future, if the value of that intangible asset turns out to be zero because your drug trial failed or your brand new microchip isn't working.
Or you can't sell a strategy, like world domination, Amazon style. Well, there you go. No, it's a fascinating feature. As I say, really helps us get to grips with debt and how you should look at it. And Algie Hall and James Norrington have put together a couple of stock screens here, which look at companies' debt profile and, in the case of Algie screen, some red flags you might want to look at when assessing companies' balance sheet strength. Anyway, thank you very much. And we've got a second feature this week, which is about Mexico, which Emma Power has written. I knew nothing about Mexico until I read this feature. Quite a difficult market to invest in, but potentially very interesting in light of what's going on in North America with Donald Trump and trade deals. So, thank you, Megan, and thank you, Julia, for your contributions today. What are you working on this week? What's first up on Mad Results Rush?
I did RELX this morning, which feeds into the debt thing quite nicely. I had an interesting conversation with their chief financial officer about they paid for their share buybacks out of debt today, this half, and he explained that it was all fine, and by the second half, they will be paying it out of cash.
Excellent. What have you been working on today, Julia?
I did Diageo's results this morning.
Oh.
£2 billion share buyback announced. And
yes, wow.
And that's through cash flows, though, not through adding debt.
Okay.
And then after that, National Express. And then again, British American Tobacco. So, busy day.
Yeah. No, the booze company seems to be doing well. Diageo, obviously. Marston's, I think, has some numbers this week.
They did, yeah. Obviously, World Cup, good news for the pub groups.
Yeah.
But for Marston's, it was a bit of a combination because for the taverns business, the World Cup and the good weather have been quite good for them because a lot of the taverns have outdoor space as well, and people like to go sit outside when it's sunny and watch the World Cup outside when it's sunny. But it was not so good news for some of their like destination and premium pubs because those tend to be quite food-led rather than wet-led.
Yeah.
And people apparently don't really aren't as inclined to drive and go eat somewhere.
No, food's looking good.
And they're watching the World Cup or the weather's nice, but they do really want a pint outside.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I understand that entirely. Yeah, okay. Thank you very much. So, what else have we got in the magazine this week? We have Sector Focus on Spread Betting by Emma Powell. Algie's done another sort of screen this week, Contrarian Value, which is a pretty decent performing strategy over the years. All the usual funds and personal finance content, which they will talk about on their podcast tomorrow, including a really interesting article about platforms and what the FCA is looking at in regards to them. Lots of news section, lots in the comment section, including a very controversial bearable this week. Lots of comments on the website. There you go. We are open to all forms of opinion on the Investors Chronicle. Thank you all for listening. Thank you again, Megan. Thank you, Julia. And we'll be back again next week. See you later.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.